talk about here on the 20-minute hit this week as another world sporting organisation is engulfed in scandal. This time it's tennis. And is there match fixing taking place at the top tournaments around the globe? We also talk about Rocket Ronnie O'Sullivan. We're also going to get into Liverpool against Manchester United and, of course, the NFL playoffs, all here in just 20 minutes. I'm Ollie Wilson, BT Sport commentator and Talk Sport reporter, joining you here as always every week, along with Mr. Paul McDonald. Paul, what's been taking your fancy this week in the world of sport?
Yeah, Ronnie O'Sullivan's fantastic Masters win over Barry Hawkins was a real highlight, and what was probably one of the best Masters tournaments I've watched in a long time. So happy to speak about that one.
We'll be diving into plenty of snooker. We'll be kicking off with the tennis, of course, and I'm delighted to say that joining us here on the show to make his first appearance is a freelance writer for plenty of the broadsheets around the UK and a very good friend as well, Mr. Nick Schepanek. Nick, pleasure to chat with you, mate. How are you today?
Very good, yeah. Happy to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, Nick. We're going to kick things off today here on the show with the world of tennis. And of course, with the Australian Open kicking off this week and the season kicking off really in 2016 with the Australian Open, the first of the Grand Slams, tennis kicks off the year with a big match-fixing scandal as tennis's integrity unit, the TIU, has been accused of its lack of movement over its investigations into players involved in match-fixing scandals. Gentlemen, after the troubles with the IAAF and, of course, FIFA as well in 2015, we're kicking off the year with another big scandal in the world of sport.
I mean, it's as we all know, it's been something that's been rumoured around for quite a while, and it's just it's good, really, that something's actually been put forward that's concrete, isn't it?
It's concrete, but the lack of movement from the TIU is quite worrying in the fact that this is an investigation that's over almost 10 years old, that's only been released to the public, really, and the lack of movement on anybody who's linked with this investigation, these top players that haven't been named by the BuzzFeed or the BBC yet, and nothing's really been done yet.
My issue with this, Ollie, is I'll read you a quote from Tennis Integrity that came last week, or the start of this week, rather, which said that the great majority of the 21,000 active professional players are good people of high integrity who abhor the suggestion that the sport they love is tainted with allegations of corruption. Now, to me, that's one of the most empty quotes I've ever heard in my life, because you can still be involved in the sport and be actively involved in corruption, but when someone asks you the question, you're obviously going to deny it, and that seems to be the problem here. Tennis has turned a blind eye to this for too long, and I think it's about time that they stepped up, not only in terms of match fixing in this issue here, but if you look at the overarching issue of doping in sport as well, the number of doping tests that are actually carried out in competition in tennis is paltry compared to the amount of people they actually catch, and I think that's something else that needs to be looked at. But for now, to deal with this issue at hand, they need to be willing to do a lot more digging than making a sweeping statement like that, which really doesn't mean anything in the modern media.
I mean, when you're talking about statements, the ATP president said it was it exists, but it's an incredibly small level, which is like saying, you know, people being a tiny bit pregnant. You know, if any sort of any cheating, any match fixing is to be stamped out. But don't you agree that one of the problems here is that tennis must be one of, I suppose, the easiest games in which to throw a sport? If you throw something like football, everybody's going to know about it. If you throw any team sport, but with tennis, you've just got to, you know, hit easy balls back down the middle that won't necessarily look like anything dodgy, and you know, perhaps an opponent would might know about it, but might equally just pounce rather gratefully on some easy shots and just smack them back.
Well, and
I think one of the issues also, Nick, is to do with the disparity of salaries earned in tennis. The top 25 maybe in the world, certainly the top 10, earn a handsome living playing tennis. But if you're ranked 300 in the world or something like that and you're playing at an ATP event, the chances are that you're barely going to even cover your travel and expenses to make that tournament. And if it approaches you, we can make a quick buck out of playing not to the best of your ability in order to make sure that somebody else wins. You might be tempted to do it. And that's something that the ATP also has to look at, how that spread of cash extends down through the ranks of tennis. And it's something that Andy Murray and Novak Djokovic have also spoken about previously, that they believe that the level of earnings at the very top of the game just hasn't flown down enough. And it leads to incidents like this where guys are having to pick up sponsorship just in order to make it to tournaments. I mean, I remember James Ward mentioning recently that to play at Queen's, he had to get a sponsorship in order to even make that tournament. So, yeah, It's an overall wide issue in tennis. It has to be resolved.
Talking about massive amounts of travel and all the expenses that go with those things, yeah.
There are also, though, 16 top 50 players that have been linked with this scandal as well. It's not just the small-time Grand Slam winners have been linked as well, but not named, as I say. Moving away from the world of tennis to snooker now, Rocket Ronnie O'Sullivan is certainly back to match-winning form once again, winning the Masters tournament this week in a highly impressive final victory over Barry Hawkins. 10-1 equals Stephen Davis's 9-0 finals record at the Masters. Paul, I know you're a big snooker fan, so I'm going to ask you this first. What means more to Ronnie, coming back and winning this Masters or equaling perhaps Stephen Hendry's world championship record of 7 wins at the World Championship that could also happen with Ronnie's career?
Yeah, I think he's back in order to prepare himself for the World Championship. Let's not forget that the Masters itself is a really established tournament, and to be honest, I've watched some of the greatest match play snooker in this tournament that I've seen in a very long time. Liang Wanbo versus John Higgins and Trump against Neil Robertson were two matches of the absolute highest quality. And I just think that the overall standard of snooker at the moment is so high that if you give the opposition player one chance to get in amongst the balls, they are generally clearing up. That being said, the emphatic nature of O'Sullivan's victory means that he's just still a cut above everyone else, despite the fact that he's only playing in limited tournaments across the year. So, yeah, once the World Championship rolls around in April, Ronnie's still going to be the guy to beat.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, the decision to take all that time off obviously paid. And I wonder if it was a question of getting appetite back. But then I think the things that mark out those champions is that hunger all the time, you know, the desire, OK, you've got 6 Masters titles, go for a number 7. You got 6 World Championships. Number 7's very much in his sights. And a lot of us would be happy to think, I've won 1, maybe 2. Let someone else have a go. But that relentless desire to just keep piling up the trophies is something that marks out the top competitors from the rest, isn't it?
He was pretty frustrated by his semi-final performance against Stuart Bingham, who was the man who beat him in the quarterfinals in the World Championships. How much of that disappointment do you think was enough to kind of inspire him on to destroying Hawkins as he did in the final? And how big of a mental challenge was that? Because that was his last major loss was at the World Championships at the Crucible back in last April.
I just think that you have to take everything that Ronnie O'Sullivan says with a pinch of salt. The guy has obviously got a love-hate relationship with snooker. That's well documented. He wants to succeed in the sport, but he doesn't want to dedicate so much time to it. And he just happens to be one of the most naturally gifted snooker players of all time. So, yeah, the comments were pretty cryptic. And to be honest, I'm getting a little tired of when he says things like that. I'd rather he just focused on his own game and focused on talking about how keen he is to match Henry and Davis's record. But yeah, listen, the guy's an awesome player. And if you're talking about motivation, I remember Stephen Henry mentioning that after he'd won his 6th World Championship, he had one glass of champagne that night, then he was on the practice table for 12 hours the next day. That's dedication, and that's somebody that O'Sullivan is looking to aspire to in order to get this Magic 7 himself.
Is it almost bad for the sport then that you've got someone like Ronnie who's got such a love-hate relationship, who is the dominant player at the moment when he wants to be and when he's on form in world snooker? Is that positive or negative for the sport at this point?
But you see this in all sorts of sports, don't you? I mean, remember when Sampras dominated tennis, a lot of us were just thinking, why doesn't he, give someone else a chance? And McEnroe, perhaps a better example, if you talk about love-hate relationships with crowds, tennis and everything. But, those people are also box office. The big names are the people that some spectators, perhaps most, would want to go and see. And they're the ones who keep people coming in all the time.
And, of course, Ronnie is such a relatable chap as well, the boy from Essex, a phenomenal world snooker player. And surely will go down as one of the greatest all time. How can he eclipse Stephen Hendry? That's yet to be seen. But Ronnie with a superb victory at the Masters. Now, let's move on to something that was a bit of a big disappointment, really. Gentlemen, I'll kick this off with a quote that I saw on Twitter recently from a friend of mine, who said that Liverpool against Manchester United is the game that defines English football. And what we saw last Sunday, I think, if that's what English football is, quite depressing, gentlemen.
Yes, I wouldn't like to hold that up as the game defining the match. I mean, okay, as a fixture, it often has, and it's often meant an awful lot. But I think the point was made that, in the past, after if Manchester United had beaten a decent Liverpool side of a couple of years ago, then they'd have been coming off Wayne really would have been pumping his fist, but they were almost apologetic walking off. And for Van Gaal to say afterwards, you know, that this was the sort of game that had reignited their championship challenge, you know, you just think, you wonder, you know, he's been accused of not watching the same games ever. I'm not sure he's watching the same league as anybody else. It, there was somebody said it was ninth against sixth, and it really looked it, didn't it?
100%, but it's what you kind of expect when you look at these starting lineups for the two sides, when perhaps Liverpool's arguably their best, most talented player on the pitch is either Adam Lallana or Jordan Henderson. I don't think either of them you'd really call world class at this point. And for United in that starting 11, you probably look at David De Gea, perhaps Chris Smalling, just because of the way he's played this season so far. But in these two great sides of English football, there are very few players that would make even a top 5 or 10 teams in and around Europe at this point.
I think the fact that the majority of the world-class players that play in the Premier League at the moment are goalkeepers tells you everything you need to know about the standard of the league at the moment. I think Ozil aside, potentially Aguero when he's fit, you're looking then at Joe Hart, Courtois, you're looking at De Gea, Lloris, even down to guys like Butland. These are excellent goalkeepers, but there just isn't the standard of quality outfield that we see at the moment. I mean, like you only have to go back 5 or 6 years when United had an utterly dominant team and they had Berbatov, Ronaldo, Tevez all playing in the same side. They'd be killed for one of those guys at the moment at their peak. I thought United's performance was utterly depressing. And I just think that Van Gaal needs to realise that there's ways of winning, and United historically under Ferguson have won well and won with flair and with luxury performances. And I haven't watched a single Man United game this season where I would actually want to part with my cash and go and watch them again. I think they're really, really poor.
Yeah, I mean, it's always said, isn't it, that that Arsenal are probably the team that most neutrals would pay to go and watch. But the last time I saw them play was against Newcastle. And honestly, you know, Newcastle could have won that game 3-0. And if Arsenal can't entertain you, then no one can. Very interesting when people talk about the Premier League as being this fantastically saleable product. And, you know, it's competitive. And you know that every team is going to go at every other team in every fixture. But it's very revealing how few players playing in the Premier League were in the Ballon d'Or conversation. And that is a problem. We've got perhaps, you know, great clubs occasionally entertaining teams, quite often entertaining matches, but the great players, as you say, they're not here at the moment.
Yeah, struggling for world-class talent really in the Premier League at this point. Just quickly, gentlemen, what is the game that is England's defining league fixture then, if you will?
Stoke against Arsenal. Anything with Stoke in, because no, was it just for the simple reason that Stoke used to be the byword for a particular type of football, but they've changed that that perception completely. So it just proves what's possible with an injection of money. Some perhaps even Stoke against West Ham.
Yeah, that would I don't think there's many Premier League fans that, especially Premier League TV companies, that would be putting that as their banner.
But if you
game.
Think about it, you've got Shaqiri and Payet. You know, imagine those two players playing for Stoke and West Ham 10 years ago.
That's true.
And just to touch on that as well, Ollie, the Deloitte money list for 2015 arrives tomorrow, and I've had a look at the embargoed list today. And
have you seen the new name at the bottom?
Yes, West Ham are in the top 20.
Wow.
So, yeah. Deloitte also reckon that by the time 2018 rolls around, we'll put the podcast out tomorrow. but by the time the 2018 rolls around, all 20 Premier League teams will be in the top 30 in the Deloitte money list, which tells you everything you need to know, I think.
Unbelievable. Let's move away to another big money sport, and there's plenty riding on the next few games coming up in the NFL, of course. The AFC and NFC Conference Championship games coming up this weekend. The playoffs have produced incredible games, and while everybody was saying how disappointing Liverpool against Manchester United was on Saturday, Green Bay against Arizona, arguably one of the greatest playoff games that you will ever see. Nick Schepanek, am I being too kind? Am I over embellishing how great this game was?
No, I don't think you are. No, the excitement level seems to ratchet up week by week, and you know, I'd sat through a kind of disappointing New England Kansas City game, you know, when New England jumped out to a lead with their first possession and they never gave it back, and then you had the kind of the opposite of that, you know, and of course, a nice bit of sort of controversy as well, you know, with the coin toss and everything, and people sort of coming out afterwards and, you know, and saying that that's got to be a reason to change the rules. But no, you know, two fantastic offensive teams, and you know, and then the next day as well, you know, an unbelievable game between Carolina and Seattle, you know, with talk about a game of two halves or, you know, four quarters. No, it's been amazing, and this weekend could be just as fantastic.
I don't think I've seen a player as determined as Larry Fitzgerald to almost physically pull the rest of the 52-man squad along with him into the end zone to get Arizona through that game and into an NFC Championship game. And Larry Fitzgerald has played out of his skin when so many people this year said that he was over the hill as a wide receiver. Are the old legs going to have enough pace left in them? Is he going to have enough power in him? And he's proving everybody wrong. 176 yards in the game-winning touchdown against Green Bay. An absolutely phenomenal performance from him. Do Arizona have enough, though, to beat Carolina, who were unbelievable out of the blocks against Seattle, putting up that 31-point halftime lead? But they do have worries at cornerback this weekend.
Well, I mean, they've got a great quarterback. You know, they've got a quarterback who, I must say, was carrying my fantasy team for the whole of the season as well. and they'll look at what happened to Carolina in the second half against Seattle and think, well, you know, there's some people got nervous. And I think Cam Newton referred to people having, what should we say, rather tight posteriors in that second half. You know, Seattle were coming back at them. So they'll look at that and think, well, you know, Seattle did it. You know, we're maybe not Seattle, but, you know, we're a good football team. And that will be in the back of Carolina's mind. You know, they can jump out to another 30-point lead, but in the back of their mind will be what happened in the second half of that game. And in a way, you know, the pressure is on Carolina being the home team there. And I think Arizona will go into that game thinking, you know, we can do some damage against them.
And Arizona have that phenomenal secondary, which, however good Cam Newton is with his arm at quarterback for the Carolina Panthers, that secondary has been able to shut down so many excellent quarterbacks this year. Pats against Broncos is in the AFC Championship game. Manning against Brady, number 17. Where do you sit on the fence with this one, guys? Who's better, Manning or Tom Brady, and who's taking their team to the big game?
It's Brady all the way for me, Ollie, I think. Yeah, Manning has shown his age more than ever now, and Brady's been here, seen it and done it so many times. Yeah, I think Brady's and Manning locked this one, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's going to be Patriots against Panthers in the final.
Yeah, which of course was one of the great great Super Bowls when they played that down in Jacksonville. A guy called Jake DeLome. Anyone remember him? Brady, of course, is still there. It's interesting, actually. If you look at the head-to-heads, I think Brady leads 11-6, is it something like 11-5? But in the playoffs, it's 2-2, and in the championship games, it's 2-1 to Manning. The Patriots have, I think, six and won two games in Denver over the last eight. So I think there is reason to think that Denver have a chance, but I tend to agree with you. Manning's banged up, and Brady seems ageless, so I'd give it to New England, I think, just.
Gentlemen, 60 seconds on the final topic as we're running out of time. Cam Newton tearing down the 12 flag, of course, the iconic 12 that is the Seattle Seahawks supporters, that means so much to that team and has really helped drive that team onto the greatness that they've had over the last two, three seasons now. Cam Newton tearing that flag, though, down from the railings in Carolina after that victory, throwing it to the ground, and an open letter to Cam Newton this week saying that he showed too much disrespect to the fans of Seattle. And before anybody says that this is an overblown letter, imagine what would happen if a Liverpool player picked up a United scarf and just threw it down to the ground like that at Anfield in that game. Are we being too politically correct with our athletes, or do they have to hold themselves to a higher standard now these days, particularly with the fans that pay all that money for them?
To me, no. I don't believe in any kind of suggestion that sports stars should be held to higher account because they've got people looking up to them. I just think that's wrong. But Newton in this case perhaps was a bit aggressive with the way he threw the flag down. I'll take that point. But so what? I mean, to me, it just sounds like sour grapes from a set of supporters that have lost another game. As simple as that.
Yeah, Cam Newton's been attracting a number of open letters from fans this year. And, you know, what? I mean, I had to write a fairly negative story about an NFL player, and I just phoned up an NFL person to warn them. it was coming, and he just said, you know what, there's no such thing as bad publicity. So the NFL is populated by people who behave slightly badly. Well, that's just great for business, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think we've seen plenty of stories about NFL players over the last few years or so that throwing a flag down probably isn't the worst thing that the NFL media department has had to do.
Just to finish off on that, Ollie, what do you think's worse, Cam Newton throwing a flag down or Pac-Man Jones almost beheading somebody last week?
Yeah, that is
something to think about.
That is true, and I wasn't jumping to Pac-Man's defence last week, but yeah, very true indeed. Paul. Right, we're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen, because we're running out of time. Nick, a massive thank you for joining us on the show today. And Paul, I'll catch up with you, of course, next week. Remember to catch us on Twitter at 20MinuteHit, at 20MinuteHit, and of course, subscribe on iTunes as well. We'll be back next week. Have a very good week of sporting action, and we'll be wrapping it all up again next Thursday. Have a good one.